had no voice, so that's why I asked Alan to kindly provide all these gadgets so that I don't have to shout a lot. So if during the parts of this program, if my voice becomes scratchy, you can't hear me, please let me know, okay? So what we are proposing to do, and I know Alan said we want to do some meditation, but we don't really have time, so I'll just let you drop for a little while after this. I'll just give you the format of what we like to do. So basically, I think that so much interest, so much information about mindfulness, so much junk about mindfulness, that we thought we'll have this session as a Q&A kind of format. The first half of the talk will be more on the applications, and I'll see how many of you already know some of the basic stuff, and I won't go into that. But I want to keep you informed about the current research and what mindfulness and meditation is currently being used with. So you can find that's why it's so exciting. In the second half, we'll have a Q&A kind of format where we talk about the myth, misconception, all the nonsense you hear, like, you know, now they have mindful yoga, mindful cushion, mindful eating, mindful food. I mean, mindful eating is run by a friend of mine, so that's very good. But you've got mindful restaurant and all kinds of things, right? So we want to try and separate the myth, the misconception, and also help you to cultivate real understanding about the practice. So this is where Charles will be joining me, and we're happy to take any questions, right? And also we're going to put up some slides on what we think are some of the myths and what we think are some of the real understanding, just topic headings, and then you're free. Feel free to just, you know, go from there and ask any questions. So we don't want this, the second half, to be just us talking. I mean, you know, Charles and I can talk till the cows come home, as Ellen would probably tell you. But we don't want that. What we're trying to find out is, what are some of your understanding, right? Some of your misconception or some of your ideas, so that we can help clear the air. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So now back to my question. How many are familiar with meditation? Okay. How many are not familiar with meditation? Never done it before? Yeah. How many are familiar with the Buddha's teachings? Okay. How many are not? That's okay. You don't need to be shy. The less you know about the Buddha's teaching, the more Buddhistic you are. Okay, you have a beginner's mind. Because I just want to know how much basic information I need to bring. Okay, so basically you know who the Buddha is. You know that he's not a woman. Right? Okay, that's fine. Okay. Now, if I stand around here, can you all see the slides?
Yep.
Okay, so if we think about it, and this is usually, I think, something that we actually don't think about, that about knowledge, there's two ways of knowing, right? Knowing about yourself, or knowing for me about myself. Say, for example, you know that I was a lawyer before, I like to crack jokes, you know, I don't take anything seriously, I lost my voice, and so on and so forth. So that's a factual information about me. And that will be the same thing about you too, what course you're doing, what country you come from, and so on and so forth. Then there's knowing yourself. So in my case, knowing myself, I will be looking at how I respond under stress, how I react to criticism, how sensitive I am, what are my emotional triggers, you know, how am I in relationship with others. So at a very much deeper level, right? Knowing yourself is the same thing. What, not just what you like, what food you like, but deeper as to, you know, how you're conditioned, right? How's the impact of your family of origin does on your emotions, you know, how likely are you to anger, to react, and so on and so forth. So this is knowing yourself. And this is where mindfulness and meditation comes in, is the knowing from the inside out, okay? And most of us know about ourselves at this very superficial level, right? And if you see at politics now, there is a lot of knowing about that level, We know about this, we know about the budget, we know about all the kind of things. But knowing ourselves, knowing where the country is going, knowing what it means to be an Australian, and all that kind of thing, that's a deeper knowing, right? So meditation and mindfulness allows us to get in touch with this deeper sense of ourselves. And most of this time, most of this deeper sense is either experiential, coming from the intuition, rather than from the head, right? A lot of it is instinctive, right? When you walk into a dark corner and you know that you are frightened, right? You know that this is just instinctive, okay? And then you start to intellectualize about it and say, well, you know, this is not true. I've walked down this so many times and all that kind of thing. I don't have to worry. That's the knowing about. Do you all see the difference? Right? So meditation and mindfulness is to allow you to get in touch with this aspect of knowing. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, it's very... Hi, welcome. It's very important, I think, for us to understand that in order to understand why meditation and mindfulness practice is so important. Okay, now I'm going to look at this of the essence of the Buddha's teaching, the basic doctrines and all that. But I'm not going to really touch on that because I'm going to give you the background of what the Buddha is trying to teach in terms of his work. And then later on, when we're looking at some of the myths and the misconception, you will see how much of that can be laid against what the Buddha is trying to teach. Okay? So this is just for you to establish a kind of baseline. So some of the things are, the teachings are not dogmas or article of faith. So there's no such thing as Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not. The Buddha doesn't talk about that. Right? He doesn't talk about what you should do or shouldn't do. He talks about right understanding, right thoughts, right action and all that. And the right is what frees your mind from remorse. Okay? So you yourself take the responsibility to know what frees you to be at peace with yourself. So there is not a lot of you cannot do this, you cannot do that. And then you see, then you start to reconcile how is it that when sometimes you go to the temples or sometimes you go to different monastery or different organizations or whatever, they tell you there's lots of things you cannot do, right? Because the Buddha says so. That's nonsense. The Buddha never said anything. The Buddha says no for yourself. And which leads us to the second thing, that the basic aim of the Buddha's teaching is to enable people to gain direct insight into the truth for themselves. Right? So you try it, you like it, it's good for you, keep it. And that was his first teaching to the Kalama clan. You don't like it, it's not good for you, you feel very negative about it, discard it. Okay? And he says, don't rely on books or whatever, don't rely on anybody telling you, try it for yourself. So it's very experiential. It emphasizes direct experiential knowledge rather than intellectualizing. But then, we have thousands of books on Buddhism. And now with the mindfulness, this explosion, you know, sometimes I go on the internet, I had to give a talk to the hospitals and doctors. I found there was 38 million hits just on the word mindfulness. Now, are there 38 million mindful people in the world? I don't think so. Right? So there's a lot of nonsense out there. Now, the Buddha teaches an attitude rather than affiliation. We'll talk more about that later on. And this attitude he talks about is based on acceptance and letting go. Okay? And again, we can open it up for discussion, what it means. And it's grounded on seeing. Right? So you actually have to look at what's going on. Knowing and understanding. And people say, but I see it and know and understand every day. Right? But if you do it through your own filter, your own judgment, your own subjective reaction, you're going to see it as very, very biased. Okay? It's your own associative thinking. And that's why meditation and mindfulness helps you to clear all these subjective biases and see for itself. And the Buddhist philosophy and psychology is to understand what are the causes of suffering and what is the way out. That's what the Buddha talks about. The word dukkha doesn't mean suffering. This is a very big
bad English translation of dukkha. Dukkha means what are the causes of wanting things to be permanent when we know that it, in reality they're not. Right? What are the causes of your suffering now, thinking about your exams 2 weeks from now? True? How many people's mind are here now? Or they're with the first paper 2 weeks later from now? You know what? You're not going to pass exams better 2 weeks from now, but you're also not going to listen to me now if your mind is somewhere else. Okay? So you're causing yourself suffering by being here thinking, you know what, I really should go and listen to Belinda Charles. But then you have this guilt consciousness that says, you know what, I really should be at home studying, right, and doing these notes and all that. And in terms of mindfulness, they will say, you're neither here nor there. You know what you're with? Anybody can guess? If you are experiencing this guilt about wanting to be here but wanting to be home, you know what you're really with? Anybody? Yeah?
Future?
No. Nope. Yeah, your mind is with the future with your chair in the room, right? And it's not really here. But what you really are present to is your feelings of guilt, right? Because you're feeling bad, you shouldn't be here, you should be there. You know, so neither your work nor your being here wins, okay? What is actually getting the uppermost in your mind is this feeling of, should I? So what you're present with is your internal rumination, right? And mindfulness helps you to see that's what you're doing, and let it go. Does that make sense? Right? So what I'm trying to show you, and Charles and I are hoping to show you, that mindfulness is not something lofty out there. Mindfulness meditation is something you can use right now, right here. Okay? And the teachings are grounded on individuals taking personal responsibility. Okay? And you can see now in Australian politics and all that, we got this age of entitlement, right? You take away, you ask, and I'm not being political or anything, you know, to ask them to pay $7 co-payment for the GP's fees. Gosh! I think it's like you're telling them to pay $1 million, right? But I don't know how many people actually spend more than $7, I don't know, just walking down the street going to McDonald's. Do not mean this sense that why should we? Why should we take any personal responsibility for ourselves, right? Because we're so used to getting it. And so the Buddha's teaching is about seeing what you can do for yourself. Okay? So this is the Eightfold Path. Anybody don't know this? Everybody knows this? Right? Yeah. Well, the Eightfold Path is called the Fourth Noble Truth. So the Buddha teaches the fourth truth, right? And this is the fourth truth, which says that there is a way out of the suffering. Right, and he talks about right speech, right action, right livelihood, which is in the realm of morality. Okay, now morality and ethics are very different. Okay, this, so when the Buddha talks about this kind of morality, it's about ethical action. Okay, you know for yourself, right? Like for example, you know, sometimes you tell your friend something and they don't do it, and then something happens. And then you're very tempted to say, see, I told you so, right? But you know your friend is already hurting. You know that they already know, right? Maybe the right speech at that time is noble silence, right? So it is right based on each unique situation. Then there is that mental culture, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Right? This is the training of the mind. And then the wisdom factor, which is right understanding, right thoughts. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is to show you that mindfulness and meditation is actually located within the Buddha's teachings of the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth. It's not, you know, people now so focused on mindfulness and meditation, they forget that the Buddha teaches a lot of other things. And this is just three, you know, mindfulness and concentration and all that, just two of the things that he talks in the eight things, okay? And so the focus is, you know what, I just keep my mind calm. I don't have to practice right action, Okay? Every time my mother yells at me, I breathe. I don't have to worry about what she's saying. Right? That is a lot of the misconception, the misapplication. Okay, so I'm looking at this theoretical foundations. Now I'm going to go very briefly about this. So there are two types of meditation, and the word bhavana in Buddhist practice, right? There's no such word as meditation in the Buddhist text. It's bhavana, and it means mental cultivation and discipline, because what you're really doing is disciplining your mind to stay still, to bring your mind back to the focus. Okay? How many people have gone to sleep now? Their mind. How many people? Honest enough to admit that. Now, how many people here are thinking, oh, I like that. Or I don't agree with her. How many people are having conversations with yourself? Right? So that is where the discipline comes in to say, you know, when my mind wanders, right? Pull it back. Right? That's the discipline and the mental cultivation. But without the training, it's very hard. When your mind goes off, you go there. Right? Meditation is for you when your mind goes off and say, oops, I don't know where it's gone. Come back. Okay? So that is the mental cultivation. Now, there's two types of meditation. Tranquility meditation, or be known as concentration meditation. The Pali word, which is in italics, is called samatha. And this is not unique to Buddhism, because you have yoga practice, transcendental meditation, and that's why when people only understand concentration meditation, they always say, oh, this is like what my yoga teacher, she asked me to watch her breath, watch her breath. So what is the difference? It's just like relaxation, right? And this type of practice exists when the Buddha started teaching. So it is true. It's not unique to Buddhist practice. The other one is insight, called Vipassana meditation, now known as mindfulness practice. And the difference here is, later on when I look at the important factors in meditation, is with concentration practice, you focus on one object. That's why they call it the practice of one-pointedness, like the breath or the flowers or anything, and calm down your mind. Okay? With the mindfulness practice, insight meditation, you don't focus on one object to calm the mind. You actually be aware of the workings and the nature of the mind. Okay? Now, when you anger comes through or anxiety comes through, you watch it, you notice that there's a lot of anger, right? And then you notice that if you trail after that feeling, you get more anger, more anxiety, or whatever, it grows. If you let it go, maybe another feeling will come up. So you constantly watch the workings of your mind, right? And you also watch the nature of your mind. You begin to see how quickly you are prone to anxiety, how quickly you are prone to stress. You can see that in real time. That is mindfulness. Okay? Being aware of what's happening to you and in you as it is happening. Okay, this is unique to the Buddhist practice, because the Buddha says it's very good to calm your mind, you know, have discipline and all that, but it's more important for you to have the insight into the workings of your mind, right? And the reason we normally combine the both things is if your mind is not calm, but you get too much insight and you see yourself as being angry or reactive, sometimes you cannot tolerate the insight. Okay, so you have a bit of the calmness and the insight. So most of the time people will do practice concentration meditation 10-15 minutes through the day, and the rest of the day you can always be mindful. You are in a state of mindfulness, right? And we'll talk more about this. So there are three factors. Now, is this basic to all of you? Do you need me to deal with this or not? Like all these things, yeah.
Yeah, it's
good.
Yeah,
sure.
It's good? Yeah. You heard it before, I'm sure.
But we always forget.
Well, at least Alan is honest. Excuse me. So there are three important factors in meditation. The first thing is right concentration, which is focusing the mind on one object to the exclusion of others. Okay? So there are 40 objects in the Buddhist practice. You can focus on the breath, loving kindness, mantra, candle, prayers, or anything that really helps you to settle the mind, right? But the most important thing when you use an object of concentration is to make sure that it does not create more thinking, it does not create more association, right? And that's why the breath is often used, because the breath is something you bring with you, right? And you can also use it as a thermometer of how you're feeling. For example, for me, when I get anxious, I'm aware that I tend to hold my breath, right? So I don't have to wait till my thoughts get anxious before I actually deal with it, right? As soon as I hold my breath, I know that I'm feeling anxious because my body is anxious. I can start to drop into breathing or do something or whatever. So you have your own signature, alright? The next factor is right effort, which is applying the right amount of effort to sustain your concentration, right? And like now, if you're tired, you want to go home, you want to read your books, you're going to find that you need more effort than if you're watching a movie. Okay? And sometimes, when you're very tired and people try to meditate, I tell them that the right effort is actually to go to sleep. Right? Because no matter what I do, I cannot concentrate. I cannot meditate. Same thing with study. Right? Sometimes you just read the book because you find that you have to read the book. And then, about 10 minutes later, you said, what was that about? You go back again and again, and you know that you either have applied too much effort, but not necessarily the right effort. Right? So the word right is very important. It means what is useful, right? What is skillful. The Buddha never talks about bad or evil. He always says, is this skillful? If it's not skillful, then drop it. So in terms of our Buddhist practice, there's no sin or guilt. There's no, bad things that happen to you. The Buddha always uses this word, is it skillful? Because skillfulness involves this ability to reflect, right? Is it appropriate to this situation? So it calls for a lot of insight into yourself, and that's why I talk about knowing yourself as opposed to knowing about yourself. Then you have the third factor, which is right mindfulness, right? Which is just paying bare attention, non-judgmentally, non-reactively, and I usually have this acronym label which I teach people to do mindfulness practice, but we're not going to do that. But I want you to, what I want you to do now is I just teach you a 1 minute meditation, okay? And I want you to use that throughout this talk whenever you find yourself not being here, okay? And all you have to do is I like you to just take a deep breath, breathing in, and then breathe out slowly. Breathing in again, and breathe out. Do that 3 times. Okay? And each time you find yourself getting ruminative or wondering or whatever, just bring yourself back to the breath in this way. I say to my clients, this is what I call a 1 minute meditation, right? Because it helps you to break this circuit of rumination. Okay? Now, because most of us, when we have thoughts or feelings or emotions, what is our normal reaction? What is our normal reaction? I'll come back to the other ones later on. Our normal responses to difficult or negative feelings, we either express them, right? Like, get out of my way, even though blah, 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 and you can see all this road rage and people parking and all that. You repress them, right? Okay, don't want to talk about it, leave me alone, right? You deny them. What, me angry? Never angry. Or you avoid them. That's normal. If you do any of these things, you are a human being, okay? Our positive feelings, we tend to get attached to them. Oh, come on, give me more of that. Oh, I had the best date last night. Okay, text, text, text. When are we getting together again, right? You want more of the same. More of positive meditation. Yesterday, I could sit for hours. Today, I can't. I'm trying to go back to yesterday, right? Or you do not want to let them be or let them go, right? Normal again. So mindfulness helps you encourage us to be aware of each feeling and experience as it is. Okay, good, bad, or indifferent, without needing to change or do something about it. So we just allow ourselves to be with the feeling, we make space for it, we don't identify with it. In other words, what we learn to do is to befriend that feeling. Okay? So whatever thoughts that come up for you now, whatever feelings that come up for you now, right? Just be in touch with it. And just breathe into it. Can we do that? Without all this thoughts about, oh, I like that, I don't like that, and you create more and more story. Like John Kabat-Zinn said, each morning we wake up, you know, very often we wake up, we're either tired or we're sleepy or we're happy or whatever, and that's quite normal, right? And then we create a movie about me, starring me, right? Directed by me, producing by me, because as you go along each of the minute of the day, you start to think how many people don't like you, how many emails you have to answer, how many meetings you have to get to, how many times the bus is going to hold you late, and how many trains you haven't caught, and how many assignments you haven't delivered. So that's why John said it's called the movie of me. Everything about me, right? And all you wake up was 9 o'clock and says, you know, maybe it's a nice day. But we don't, do we? Right? As soon as we wake up, we are already about me. Okay, so mindfulness allows you to say, okay, you wake up, you sit for a while, I'm feeling lousy. Okay, let it be. I'm feeling good. Let it be. You know what I mean? You accept each feeling as it comes. Okay? Now, to go back to the earlier slide. So we talk about this right mindfulness is to pay bare attention. Bare attention means you don't hang on to it. You acknowledge it's there and you just let it be. How many of you can do that? How many of you can't do that? That's right. That's where the cultivation and the training of concentration meditation comes in, right? Because all the time you find we are evaluating, we're judging, we're liking, we're disliking. Okay? Children are not like that. Children are so innocent, right? Because they don't have this contamination of like and dislike, right? But the adult, we do. And that's why in the Buddhist text, they talk about when you do meditation, what you're doing is you're cultivating a beginner's mind, a child's mind, right? Because children are very innocent. Okay? Any questions? You can ask, you know. It's okay. I won't take offense. I got right mindfulness. But no, seriously, if anything really you need to ask, you know, to help your understanding, that's fine. If you're asking just to look smart, then it's different, okay? Okay, so concentration meditation, to sum up, is focusing on one object to the exclusion of other stimuli. It helps the mind to calm down. Insight meditation is to understand the workings and the nature of your mind. Do you understand what this means? Right? Because it's very important to understand what it means, the working. How your mind works, how it reacts, how it responds, and the nature of the mind. Because some people, and I'm sure you have friends, you say, I don't know why this person is so negative, right? Everything you tell them, they are so negative. Some people are very positive, right? That's the nature of their mind, right? And so every time you give them some news, they will pick up the most negative evidence and look at it, right? And the Buddha says, if you understand that's the nature of your mind, you don't have to condemn it. You just have to work at changing that if it bothers you. Okay? So what is mindfulness? Mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, moment by moment, non-judgmentally. This is almost like a classic definition by John Kabat-Zinn. Paying attention in a particular way, bring it back to whatever you're focusing on purpose, right? Not the wandering stuff. In the present moment, it's 7:40, this moment. Moment, my moment, 7:42. 7:43. Non-judgmentally. Okay? Not saying whether 7:42 is better than 7:43 or 7:44, right? Every moment. Can you do that? Very hard, isn't it? But you know what? when you think about it, what is the real moment? Is it 7:42, 7:43, 7:44?
It's now.
Which one?
Now.
Yeah, which one? 7:43?
What
month? Exactly, that's right. It doesn't matter. It is the now. But it's so easy for us to say now. But very often we're not, right? We're either at 7:43 or we're going to be at 7:45. We're not at this now. And the minute you say this now, you're not present to it, it's gone. Right? That's why I say don't worry about your work. Don't worry about that. Because right now you're here. This is now. Okay? But our mind tends to be, like John Kabat-Zinn always said, we live at two addresses from our body, the past or the future. We're never here now. Okay? Okay, so this is just maintaining constant awareness. I've just noticed the time and I'm running very late already. Okay, I think I've said all that before. I'm not going to go through all that. Okay, now these are the physiological benefits of meditation. There's a lot of research done on this. Dr. Herbert Benson wrote a book called The Relaxation Response, and they find that when you do meditation, your body and mind more integrated, like you're aware of how your body is reacting as your mind impacts on it, right? There's a reduction in the stress level. There's also a lowering of cholesterol level, a reduction in the blood pressure, reduction in heart rate, and increased skin resistance. And the last one is very interesting. That's why you can see a lot of the Buddhist monks. They can go up the Mount Fuji wearing a very thin robe, right? In really -0 temperature. And they wonder why they don't need that. It's because they can control, right, their reaction to the drop in temperature. And in Tibet, there are some monks who have like solitary confinement and they don't eat, and they actually can regulate their body to need so minimal things, right, because of this mind-body integration. Now, I'm not asking you to practice that, but these are what some of the benefits they've found, okay? Now, psychological benefits, I'm going to move through that because... So I want to look at the actual research. Now, the best known research today is mindfulness-based stress reduction called MBSR. It was developed by Dr. John Kabat-Zinn at the Center for Mindfulness. In fact, if you Google his name, anybody knows his work? Okay. If you Google his name, you will get at least 1,000 websites talking about his work. He's the leading proponent of this work. But there's a lot of rubbish about his work. So go to Center for Mindfulness, and that's where they, you know, John has his own personal website. Now, basically what MBSR does, and because a lot of research are now based on the MBSR, I'll just give you a very quick rundown. So MBSR is very simple. And this is the program that Charles took in America, 8 weeks. We also have an intensive professional, which I took, 10 days, you know. So if you can spare 3 months, you can go and do it with them. So what they do is they have 45 minutes of meditation or yoga, mindful yoga practice, right? And then they also give you homework and exercises, and they teach you to actually keep your focus. And we sit in practice with them the whole day, every day, and we walk, or we sit in meditation, and then we have contemplation, we have silent, noble silence, and then we actually look at how our body actually contemplate this inability to talk or to, you know, to actually be aware of our own ego. I mean, I'm just making this a very short summary. And they have both clients, instructors, people all joined together in the group. So nobody knows who is the patient and who is the doctor or so on and so forth. Okay? And we're encouraged not to ask each other what we do. We're encouraged not to tell each other what we do. So we all go there with no agenda, no egos, nothing. And for 6-7 days, you just sit, walk, meditate. Okay? And surprisingly, just this simple way of being with your body, of understanding your body, understanding how your mind works, is such a powerful technique. John started using this at first with pain management for people who, you know, they find that the doctors have given up on them and, you know, the insurance run out or whatever. And they find that if you just be with your body and you find it so painful, and some of them are in wheelchair, they just breathe into the pain. And they befriend the pain. Now just breathe in with me. Right? Because what you find is that when you are actually with the pain, it's just pain. What makes it suffering, like the Buddha says, is this, the mind that says, I don't like this, when is it going away, why am I suffering, I'm aging, I'm getting old and all that. So we can turn physical pain into emotional suffering. And so this is what John tried to do in the MBS ARCA classes, is to actually let you see pain as pain, right? And emotions as emotions and so on and so forth. But even though that's simple, it actually takes a lot of training because the mind doesn't do that naturally. Okay? Now, nowadays, his program are used, this example of some of his program, they use it. Health, hospital, mindful leadership, organization, politician. In UK, the British Parliament have just sent 30 members of Parliament to train with them. And now, in the British Parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, they sit in meditation once a month. And there's a big TV interview the other day with some of the MPs saying why they took this up, because they got depression and so on and so forth. And in America, there is a Senator, Tim Ryan, who has now introduced it to school and in the Senate, and John talks with the defense forces and the trained soldiers and so on, right? With terror, school, everything, all this, right? Just from the simple practice of bringing your mind home. Right, and being in touch with yourself. Isn't it interesting? Mm. Now, then we have this study on telomere, which I'm going to skip. Sorry. When I have time, I'll come back to that, okay? But I doubt it. I want to leave more time for the Q&A. So this is one of my colleagues who did this Zen meditation and brain imaging, Dr. Rizky in Netherlands. I have a lot of colleagues all over the world doing really exciting research on this kind of work. Now, he wanted to find out what really happens when you're meditating, right? Because people talk about, you know, all these kinds of things. He wants to find actually what happens. So he put this, anybody has gone through an MRI machine? You have, right? Yeah, I went to six of them, six MRI scan last couple of months, right? And you know that when you go through, it's very noisy, right? Anyway, he put this Zen meditators through that. He wanted to scan their brain to see what happens when they're meditating in the machine. So what he found was, you know, contrary to what people think, that there is no thinking, the brain, they scan it and they found this part is very blue. There is thinking, but the thinking is very rhythmic. That's why you're calm. The normal thinking goes like this, okay? Then they found out that this part of the brain at the back, where it's called amygdala, which is the emotional center, right? It's very green. Now, it just shows that when the mind is not stressed, right, the emotional center is very calm, very relaxed, okay? And then they found that another area of the brain, which deals with reactivity and all that, is also very calm. So basically, this kind of MRI, and this was done many years ago, so it was quite a basic, shows that when you're actually relaxing your mind, you're calming down, there is some calming effect on the brain, right, on the stress, on the immunity system, on your emotional reactivity. Okay? Now, the most famous of this kind of research was this meditation research on the neuroplasticity and immunity system by Dr. Richard Davidson. Who's heard of his work? Okay, Richard Davidson and John, they were actually classmates, right? And they both took kind of different paths. And Richard Davidson was named in 2011 as one of the most influential scientists in the year 2011 because of his work. Now, basically what Richard Davidson wanted to find was what happens to people who are reactive, right? And he finds that people who are very reactive are people who are very right tilted. So they act very fast, right? They get angry very fast, get anxious very fast, and so on and so forth. people who are more calm, more optimistic, they are more left tilted, right? I think most Australian brains are like that, right? Okay, you know, we'll be right, mate, and all that kind of thing. So he scanned thousands and thousands of people's brain, and he found that most of us are on this bell curve. Okay? Which means that most of us are in this middle area. There are some people who get very angry, very reactive, very fast, who are tilted more to the right. And people who are more rational, more logical, tilted to the left. Okay? This is what he found. Now, he then presented this finding to the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama has this institute called Mind Life Institute. Have you all heard of it? Yeah. And this institute, every 2 years, the Dalai Lama will give them a kind of research aim, right? And then they'll go and do the research and all that, and they come back and report to him. So Richard Davidson and all that reported to the Dalai Lama and says that we found that, you know, people who are reactive is right tilted, and people who are more grounded and not left tilted, right? And I was there at the conference. And it's very interesting. They show all this beautiful brain scan, right, red, blue, and all that. And the Dalai Lama, you know, anybody seen the Dalai Lama talk? You should go and see him. He's very. He goes, photos, pictures, very beautiful. Why did they get angry in the first place? They couldn't answer that. The scientists couldn't answer that. They know what it looks like. And that's why I have a bit of concern when people show scans of what a schizophrenia brain looks like and this and that. You're showing what has happened since then, right? How do you know that this is the brain of a schizophrenia before they had that? Right? So the Dalai Lama asked them, okay, this brain, yes, we know that this brain gets angry faster, this brain gets angry less, but why did they get angry in the first place? Can't tell. Does that make sense? So Richard Davidson and John Kabat-Zinn went back and they conducted a research, and also the Dalai Lama wanted to know, right, can we do something about this? Because if it's nature, you're born with right-tilted brain, why bother to meditate, right? This is what you are, right? If we cannot overcome it. So he wanted to know, is it nature or nurture, right? Because if it is nurture, the conditioning, then the practice of training the mind will help, right? But if you're born with it genetically, you're predisposed or whatever, why bother? Might as well go home, right? So the Dalai Lama is so sharp that he could ask two questions out of all these years of meditation and set the scientists think again. So, because his mind is so clear. So Richard Davidson and John conducted a study with a biotech company. Now this biotech company, you know, they are very reactive, they're very hard people to work with because there's so much changes, you know, the technology and all that. So they are very, very anxious people. So they took a control group that does nothing, just went and do the work. Another group does the MBSR 8 weeks course with John. Okay? Before that, they took their cortisol and all the kind of things, right? And they found that these people are highly stressed. Okay? Now, you know why they take cortisol level? And urine sample? Yeah, because when you're very stressed, your cortisol level goes high up. Right? You take it the night before your exams, you find your cortisol level. You take it the day after your exam, you find your cortisol level. And that's why they take your urine sample, because your cortisol is very easily shown up in your urine sample. And that's where the mind and body connection shows up. Right? You think, I'm stressed, how come it comes out of my urine? Because your body feels it. Okay? Alright. So anyway, that's a digression. So they took all this and they put them through the 8 weeks course. And at the end of the 8 weeks course, they give this control group flu vaccine shot, and then they give the other group flu vaccine shot. Do you know about this research? Anybody heard of this research before? Okay. So now, interestingly, they found that the people who didn't do any meditation just went about their own way, right? Their stress level, the cortisol still very high. The people who were doing the MBSR training, their cortisol level has dropped, the stress level has dropped. People said they were nicer to work with. They themselves feel less anxious. But more interestingly, when they check, the people who were doing meditation had 30 to 40% more antibodies and the antibodies lasted 30% longer than the people who had the flu vaccine shot but didn't do any medication. So again, it shows that when your body is not under stress, your immunity system is very robust. Does that make sense? Right. And so this was the challenge that they took up from the Dalai Lama to say, okay, if you actually train your mind, and this is just 8 weeks, it makes a difference. Okay? And it makes a difference not only to your mind, but to your whole system. Now, this is Matthieu Ricard. I'm sure you heard of Matthieu Ricard, right? He's a very famous monk. This is the scan that Richard Davidson does on him. So it's not the MRI scan where they go through the machine. They put 8 electrodes on him. So as he meditates, right, they're catching the signal. That's why they know when, you know, you're tilted to the right or left. Now, Matthieu Ricard is so calm that they found he's so tilted to the left, he's 3 centimeter deviation from anybody else. The difference between his calmness and the average person is like the distance between Earth and the Moon. And that's because Matthieu Ricard has been meditating for 30 years. But it just goes to show that it does have its effect, okay? Okay, then another well-known mindfulness research is this mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, for depression. Anybody heard of this? Now, it's now like the accepted, in psychology they call it evidence-based, right? We need evidence-based. Now, this is the new evidence-based treatment for prevention of relapse. Right? And so this is the University of Toronto, Wales and Cambridge. And what they did was they took a group of people with depression, have relapsed two or three episodes, but do not want to be on medication. So they want to try something else. And of course, they always have a control group. And what they found was the people who have experienced 2 or more episodes of depression, when they do the MBSR course, and this is the same MBSR course that John did. That's why I said a lot of research now uses his model. Right? Their risk of depression was reduced from 66% to 37%. Right? And but the rate of relapse in the population, in the control group, was still at 66%. But they found that, interestingly, that people who didn't have 2 episodes of depression doing MBCT didn't make much of a difference. And I think that one of the reasons that they're now doing research on why that's the case, I think one of the reasons they find is that when a person who has propensity to be depressed tend to what they said, they get into that groove. Right? It's like you're playing the CD again and again. So whenever they get depressed, they fall into the groove of that ruminative negative thinking. Okay? So because MBSR mindfulness thing has a lot to do with actually training the mind not to ruminate and all that. I think it's probably more effective for people who are not already so prone to that kind of negative thinking. Okay, but it was a very curious finding on their part. But they also found that people tend to move from autopilot, right, to a more objective decentering mode. And this is why that's helping them from going back into depression. So they're able to see, okay, my thoughts are not me. Okay? Usually people who tend to be anxious or depressed tend to say, I have anxious thoughts, I'm an anxious person. Okay? People who actually are able to move back a bit, they will see, well, these are anxious thoughts at 7:42. It doesn't mean I'm always going to be an anxious person. Do you understand about this decentering, stepping back a bit? And meditation and mindfulness gives you the ability to pull yourself back from whatever is happening to you at that moment. Okay? And it changes from a ruminative way of thinking to a mindful way of being. So they're more in touch with themselves rather than in their head. Okay? And they tend to focus more on the present than all the past negative events. The biggest trigger of depression we found is the tendency to go back to negative events, the past negative events. Right, and to stay there. Right? And mindfulness has this ability to get you back into this present moment, now. Okay, and also to learn to see those negative thoughts as just mental phenomena rather than as facts. Very powerful, right? Because most of us, we think, and then we say, therefore I am. Right? Now they say, I think, well, that's my state of mind at that point of time. Right? And so this is now used with Beyond Blue in Australia, with Black Dog Institute, with a lot of the hospital. Just very simple way. This one has no side effects. Okay? You can do meditation wrongly, no side effects. And that's why in UK now, if you have depression, this is one of the recommended method of treatment. Right. So I'm just giving you a glimpse. There are lots of other research. I have no time to go into that. I'm just giving you a taste of the research that's going out there. And the ones I'm giving you are the good research. The research that's made a difference, that's laid a foundation for this kind of practices. It doesn't mean that I agree with everything they do, but at least they are aware of what they're doing, right? For example, the one of this one is very interesting. I interviewed Dr. Teasdale at Cambridge University when I was doing my PhD about this program that they were doing. And that was when they first started in 1995. And I said to him, do you put in the Dharma and the Buddhist teaching, like letting go and letting be and all that? He says, Belinda, we don't even call it mindfulness. I say, what do you call it? We call it attentional training. Right? In those days, 1995, it's a bad word to use Buddhism, mindfulness. Now, everybody's mindful and everybody is this. You know what I mean? Times have changed. So there is a bit of a fad here. And now, interestingly, Teasdale has actually retired from being a professor at University of Cambridge. He's a meditation teacher. Right? Because when they first wrote the book called MBCT, right, it's very technical, it's quite cognitive, and it's more for therapists. I find it very hard to give it to my clients, right? Because they actually haven't gone for the training with John. Later on, they found that they couldn't actually do this work without going for the actual training. So they went back and did the MBSR course. And then they wrote another book called The Mindful Way Through Depression. Same authors with John Kabat-Zinn in there. And you can see that qualitatively it's very different. And if any of you are interested, buy that book, not the first book, because the second book has a lot of people's stories and it's very Buddhistic, and there's a CD from John. So it just goes to show that they themselves, and I take my hat off them for them to acknowledge that they themselves need the personal practice. You cannot talk about meditation, train people to meditate without you yourself having that kind of practice. Okay? Okay, now, it's 8 o'clock, so I do want to open it up to other questions. Now, is there any question from this first part of the talk?
Can you talk a little bit about mindfulness, the research on mindfulness and cancer?
Mindfulness and cancer, okay. This is a very old research. I haven't caught up really with what's happening. So I'm just giving you an idea. This is by Professor Walker at the University of Hull. What he wanted to do was actually to see whether when you're doing meditation and visualization, can you actually, this is a form of loving kindness, right? Can you actually increase your immunity system to wish your body well? So what they did was, and these are the people who have gone through the operation, have gone through chemotherapy and all that. I think the best thing about mindfulness practice is they're not asking you to give up whatever you're doing. It's usually an adjunct, right? So they taught people to meditate, but also in the meditation to actually visualize the red white cells actually overcoming the white blood cells or the cancer tumor or whatever, and to wish it well. And they found that the tumor actually shrinks, right? Because basically they're using their own body immunity to actually fight the cancer, right? And this is very powerful. And one of the reasons I have a lot of clients who've got very, very serious illness that come, the doctor sent them to me. And basically what it is that when you have illnesses and all that, your body has to fight two things, right? It has to fight the illness, and it has to fight your fear about the illness, or your suffering about the illness. Okay? So meditation allows you to free your mind from all this emotional suffering, And just let your body concentrate on what it has to do, which is to heal itself. Does that make sense? So, Professor Leslie Walker, they use that kind of principle where they ask the body to visualize the body healing themselves by fighting the cancer.
Okay. What was the outcome?
Well, at that time, it was they found it was quite positive. You can follow it up by going to the internet and Google. But there are lots of other research now on cancer, you know, that is more recent than this. But it's one of those proven things with cancer and mindfulness. I do a lot of work with the clients, and one of the things that I give my clients to do is just very simple: take the tape in when you're having your chemotherapy, because you know, chemotherapy, they light down there, it's very cold, there's a very strong light shining on them, right? And you are almost naked and nobody's with you because of the strong radiation, right? And it's very hard for them not to feel negative. So a couple of my clients will take the meditation record with them or tape with them, and then they sit there and they meditate. And they find that the chemotherapy is actually more effective because they're not resisting it. They're not feeling negative about it. And in fact, one of my clients, when I teach other people in her cancer group, right, to just listen and let the body kind of receive the chemotherapy without all these negative thoughts. Okay? Any other questions? Okay.
Can I make a comment?
Sure. Go ahead.
She mentioned Richard.
Do you want the...
Well, they can hear me. If they don't, it doesn't matter. I don't know what I'm talking about anyway. Okay, she mentioned Richard Davidson, John Kabat-Zinn. The 30 years ago, when John was doing his therapy, or not his therapy, but his research, a lot of people wondered about meditation, and today meditation is a commonplace thing. Everybody talks about meditation. My days, 50 years ago, you were crazy. You had to go and sit in an ashram, you know, and be a monk or whatever it is. So John introduced meditation, and after his initial research, after there was some degree of success in that, Davidson wondered that how can religion, you know, transform a person's behavior and make them happy and make them better off. And he found in Buddhism what John was teaching, which is actually based entirely on the Dharma. But he didn't have to say that, because if he said that, nobody would buy his book. Even now, they are still, you know, not accepted. So he made it scientific and everything else, and it became accepted. Today, everybody claims to be a meditator, and thousands of people are doing. So what it was then the Dalai Lama got interested in the act, and he says, yeah, religion, if you follow Buddhism, you will be peaceful, you will change your life, you will have a very happy life. In John's case, he accepted that and replaced the word suffering with stress. So I would recommend to you guys, if you want to know more about this, to read John's first published book, Full Catastrophe Living, where he addresses this, and John Davidson's book. Richard Davidson's book. And a third book, which subsequently came in, is Daniel Siegel's book. And you will know all about the effects, the scientific effects of meditation on human attitudes. And John's whole MBSR program was to eliminate the ego in you. And once you can overcome that ego in you, and you're open to receiving new information, your life could change. If you change, the world changes with you. And this is presently the Mind Life Institute's focus is on that. How do you change a person's life through meditation? And Richard Davidson's main contribution is his study of the frontal lobes, the amygdala, and the effects on the brain of certain emotional arising. And they could detect certain actions that causes that to happen. So that book is a very good book. And Daniel Siegel's Mindful Brain subsequently studied further on children. From birth, they have the basics. And then they start to program and they start to make connections. And how they make those connections would result in what kind of a person they become. And if they were very disturbed as kids, as we have now, when they grow up, they have no balance. You know? So try these three books.
The book that Richard Davidson wrote with the Dalai Lama, that's called Negative Emotions and How to Overcome Them. It's actually a publication based on the conference.
Yeah, so Richardson went into it and he discovered, amongst other things, that when you meditate, you are clear. You have no thoughts. And when you don't have those thoughts, nothing is impacting on your emotions. You're just free. And those who meditate regularly will know that. You come out of meditation feeling entirely refreshed and quite happy for a moment, and then you get back into your own ruminative self, right? And so this is a very significant contribution to the well-being, and this is why Buddhism has taken off, except in a very corrupted manner. So anybody wants to do a PhD on a treatise, please try this. Actually, I'm hoping somebody would write on this. The relationship between stress and religion. You just have to get a theme of religion, all meaning to make us better people, behave better, be more pleasant, be more charitable, be more compassionate, right? And then we'll be happy. Well, this is all shown through the MBSR program. So, take this book, John's Full Catastrophe of Living. He's got a later edition. Richardson's what brain is that?
Davidson.
Richard Davidson.
Negative emotions and how to overcome.
I don't think that's another one before that. It was printed about 30 years ago in his research. And there's another one which is Daniel Siegel on the conditioning of the brain to become. You become what you're conditioned to be. And then you connect that with the Dharma, the Eightfold Path, and you find that it corresponds entirely with the Eightfold Path. Okay? So, please, yes.
Sorry. I have a question, maybe from Linda and John.
Sorry?
My question, because I haven't read any John Kabat-Zinn's book at all, so I'm not quite sure how he wrote the book, but did he ever mention about the morality aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path?
Yes, so there's two books. The first one, Full Catastrophe Living, is basically based on the MBSR program. Actually, John ran the program and one of the publishers liked it and asked him to publish, so he never set out to publish. The other book that he wrote called Wherever You Go, There You Are, is all based on the Dharma. And that's a little thin book. That's my favorite book. So if you want scientific base, you go for Full Catastrophe Living, which sets out the program. If you want more, the Dharma, the Eightfold Path, although he doesn't call it, that is in that book. It talks about wherever you letting go, letting be, acceptance and all that. Yeah.
You just have to read the latest version of John's book. And he actually quoted Thich Nhat Hanh as a foreword.
You see, the thing with John is he's quite skillful. He knows that he started it 35 years ago. If he uses Dharma and all that, a lot of people will be turned off. So he uses stress, like Charles said. Nowadays, he's so forward. You know, he's gone to China, Taiwan, and all that. He uses the Four Noble Truths, Dharma, all the time because he feels that people are now ready. And also scientifically, a lot of evidence have shown it works. So he doesn't have to actually use another term for
it. He doesn't use those terms. But the denying fact is that suffering is caused by ourselves. If you meditate and you clear your mind, you are able to recognize within yourself the cause of the suffering, which is in the Dharma. And if you remove the cause of the suffering, what have you got? So meditation is the same thing. You cannot meditate because your mind ruminates, and you cannot move on because you've got previous, you know, hates, you know, negative emotions, as the Dalai Lama would say. And your parents didn't treat you right, or, you know, you had all sorts of diseases. And you dwell on that, and you remember that. And you cannot let go of it. Meditation brings you to now. Then sooner or later, you realize, yes, yes, I've been hanging on to that thought that has been affecting me all my life. But not now. You see? And John was not the first person to do. Eckhart Tolle wrote a book on the power of now. Anybody read that book? There are lots and lots of books written alluding to this particular aspect of living, which is us causing our own stress and our own suffering. And Buddhism is the only religion that prescribes the way of getting out of it. So you're very lucky to be Buddhist, and you have a very good opportunity from here on to make a change to the world, because they're now ready for it. Everybody is getting into aspects of the Dharma, which sounds very good, and they want to be Buddhist, or they want to teach meditation, you know, mindfulness, and thousands of books are written on that. But somebody, John himself, doesn't claim that sort of shame. All he says is, just moderate your ego and everything falls into place. Think about that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, John. So before I go on, I forgot to mention that... where am I going? Yeah, with this Davison's work, right? The most important concept in here was the idea of neuroplasticity. And that has formed the foundation for a lot of research now. The idea that you could actually train your mind to alter the way you've been conditioned because the mind is plastic. Now, this is very foundational, very important, very radical, because people think that as soon as we're born, all our genes die, everything is all downhill, right? Through his work, Richard Davidson has been able to show that the brain is so plastic, our whole body is so plastic, right, that we can actually change it through training.
You can be an entirely different person.
And also, you know that now they're finding that with genes and the body and the cells, do you know that you have a new liver every 6 months? If you go and cut a piece of your liver, it will grow back. And that's how they form now with genetic engineering now and stem cells. This is all based on the fact that the body and the mind repairs itself. Right? Now, we all know that. Like the Dalai Lama said, we all know that. The meditators know that. But for some people who are not aware and who are skeptical, he says the science helped to prove it. Right, and so this is, so he is supportive of the science community, not because of anything, but he says if they prove what we know, it's good, it helps the people who are more skeptical. If it proves what we shouldn't believe or disprove what we believe, he says I'm willing to change it. So the Dalai Lama practice a very open-mindedness, which is the basis of mindfulness. Okay, now I want to go towards the myth, and I was going to show you what one of my clients did with this, but never mind. Another day. Invite me again, Alan. Okay, this is just to show Time Magazine the science of meditation. You see, every campus now has this. And I like this Newsweek, the new science of mind and body. New is 2,600 years old. Just because the West found it, it's new. Right? If it comes from the East,
this is the point they made about Davidson's work, neuroplasticity of the brain. We never thought that, right? We never even believed that by changing your attitudes, just the way you think, just the way you see things, you could change your whole life. And actually, another person she mentioned was Matthew Ricard, the French priest. You know, he gives a very simple answer to our suffering. Make it simple. Life, make it simple. Don't confuse, don't harbor all those ailments that you had. Don't have hatred, for instance. Make it very simple. Remove all hatred. And what have you got? When you remove all these afflictive emotions from your mind, from your brain, from your system, you will have nothing but happiness. It's so simple.
But the thing is, it's simple, but it's very hard to practice without the discipline of coming back to a neutral focus whenever you get into that state. Okay? Now, so I did not prepare so many slides that I got no time for.
There you go.
But usually, okay. Now, this is what I always give to the organizations, very cute, right? Because I always ask people when I train with them, how many people took a shower with you yesterday? You're laughing. How many? Alan, how many took a shower with you yesterday? I'm not asking for your sex orgy or anything.
She's very lecherous.
Yeah. One of the organization people I trained counted 22 people, because when he was in the shower, he phoned his secretary and said, so who's coming for the meeting? He texted, right? And he emailed, and he checked his email. He was never with the shower. The water is all gone. He had 22 people in the shower with him. And that's what our mind does, right? We're never aware. And now how many people use Tinder? You know Tinder? You didn't know I know Tinder. I tell you, lots of my clients use Tinder. You know what's Tinder? Yeah. Tinder is where you sit there and you think, oh, you know what? There's this girl across the table. She looks nice. I'm going to slide her and see, like me, and then she'll left slide me and like me, and then I'll go over the table. No need to take a risk, right? If she doesn't left slide me, I don't go. Now, how can you be mindful? You're watching. Which one is sitting here, sitting there? You know, you're watching your left slide, right slide. You didn't think I know that, do you? Right? Do you use Tinder?
No.
Yeah. Tinder is now going to be...
Don't admit anything to her. Don't
worry. Tinder is now going to be bought out by Google for $3 billion.
Whoa.
Yeah, because it is one of those instant dating. You don't even have to try. You just have to click, photos of who you like, and then slide and show them.
Yeah. Psychologically, do you think it will impact the human psyche, or
who?
Impact the relationship between...
The technology?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. This is my new crusade. I got two crusades, right? About trying to reform Charles, right? Which is a lost cause, right? I hope that's not fake, yeah. I got two other crusades. One is to try and get our politicians and all that to do some mindfulness stuff like they do in UK and America. The other one is to warn parents, right, about technology. And there's this woman called Baroness Greenfield. I know we're out of time, Charles, but is it okay if I talk a little bit about that? Yeah, anyway, it's all relevant because you guys are going to have children and I'm going to be on your case soon. Okay, Baroness Greenfield is the director of the Brain Institute in UK. And she wrote a book called The Brain for the 21st Century. And her concern is that the brain for the 21st century, based on technology and all this, you know, children playing technology all the time, is you're going to have a high rate of ADHD, because children are very into instant gratification, straight away answer, right? Very hard. If I don't get it, because they're used to getting instant answer. Never mind. Also, she has found a correlation between ADHD, instant gratification, and dementia. Right? And she came to give a talk at the National Press Club here last time, because what she has found is that the genes that are responsible for ADHD is the same genes as dementia. And it's in childhood. So the genes that actually graduate towards ADHD, the instant one, right? By the time they get to this age, they burnt off. Right? These genes burn off. And so the tension between instant gratification and the utility of the brain causes a lot of dementia. Right? Because part of the brain doesn't get used. The brain that gets used is the one that seeks instant gratification all the time. So she wrote a book, she's so concerned, she's gone around the world talking about this. Right? She's called anti-technology. She says she's not. She says when my mother, who is 78, learns to email, I'm very happy. Because she's already got social network, she's got skills, she's got all this kind of thing. But when my 3-year-old grandson does this, I worry. My 3-year-old grandson does this, I worry. He can push button. Mommy, what's the password? 9999, yeah. This, that. Right? And that's okay. Occasionally it's okay. But can you imagine if the child does this all the time? So what she's seen is she scans brains that where they're constantly on technology, like your brains and all that, you find that your brain has, honestly, your brain has already shifted to the right. And she's afraid that in the 21st century, the young brains will shift more and more to the right. And more people will get more and more.
To understand that more, you read Davidson's book on plasticity of the brain. You see, you are what you become. You become what you are conditioned to become. You are happy if you are conditioned to be happy. You are unhappy if you live an unhappy life. That's all your experiences. And you become. That's the plasticity. So, but there is, in the Buddhist religion, there is a let out. You don't have to stay that way. See,
but the idea with neuroplasticity can work both ways. You can train your mind to get better, but when you constantly condition it to technology and instant gratification, it also will be that way.
Yeah, right? Because your mind, your attitudes are towards instant gratification. So your emotions require instant gratification. And after a while, you don't know anything different. If there's no instant gratification, there's nothing. So with the Buddhist, being Buddhist, you can actually alter that and save yourself. But other religions, it means hopeless. They are hopeless now.
But can you imagine if I were to invent a thing called Tinder, not Tinder, but Tinderbox, which is very simple, no app, nothing, right? Which involves walking to the table and asking, "Do you want to have coffee with me?" You think that would be popular? Right, rather than slide and say, "Would you have coffee with me?" Why can't I just walk over there and say, "Would you have coffee with me?" Why isn't that, right, common sense?
Oh, come on, you'd be ashamed if you said no. Go to
exactly.
Hell.
Exactly.
They don't know who you are.
So what they're creating is social anxiety, right? You don't have to deal, no risk, right? You don't have coffee.
We are starting to fight now. We used to come here,
right,
and she used to pick on me all the time.
Let's go on. Main misconception. This is what you came here to listen. So the first bit. Now, the myth and misconception is the one in brown and is in italics. Okay, that mindfulness is a skill or technique that can be taught and learned. Right. The right understanding is that mindfulness and meditation are about cultivating the right attitude, not the right technique. Right, and that the practice of mindfulness and meditation is experiential rather than learned, and the importance of embracing and embodying a meditative attitude. So this is Charles' favorite topic, so I'll let him talk about this.
Well, I have nothing to say about that.
Okay, wow, that will be the first time. Yeah, go ahead.
Good.
Yeah, he's open to question, okay?
Is that because...
Can you speak up, because there's a tape recorder here.
Oh, Is that because everybody will have different techniques that work for them?
So the question is, why it's not a skill or technique,
yeah,
right? Basically, as you will find from our discussion, right? Technique is something, it's a tool that you take away, right? I can sit there for half an hour and acquire the skill. And I give you an example of one of my clients. She wasn't a client, as a clinical client, but just through meditation. She wanted to learn how to be nice to her daughter, right? So she learned loving kindness meditation. This loving kindness involves sitting there and says, you know, may you be well, be happy, you know, may everybody be well and happy, and all that kind of thing. You spread loving kindness throughout the world. She does that beautifully. So every now and then she comes back and report to me, and I say, how's your meditation going? Oh, very good, very good. I can sit there for 20-30 minutes wishing everybody well. And I say, how's your relationship with your daughter? Oh, terrible. And as soon as I open my eyes, you know, I'm yelling at her because she hasn't done her homework, her room's untidy and this and that. So I made her repeat it several times. She said, why are you asking me to repeat it? I said, because what you've acquired is a technique, right? I sit there, wish everybody well, happy and all that. She doesn't have to embrace it or embody it or practice it with her daughter. As soon as she opens her eyes, she doesn't have a meditative attitude. She sees her daughter, the relationship is back to square one. So what she's acquired is a tool to calm down her mind. What she has not acquired is a way of putting in practice so that I can now calm my mind, and can I calm my mind and be in a relationship with my daughter that doesn't start yelling at her.
Can I address this one? Is do you learn to love? What's the technique for love? Can you give me a technique to learn to love? Then I can do it for her. It's doing her a favor, not me. I'm a very open person.
Too old for that. Too old.
Give me a technique for love.
Emotions.
You see? Okay, give me a technique for being mindful.
Emotions.
You see, a lot, there are two parts of us. The intellectual part, where everything can be taught and learned. There's the other part that's already in you. She's talking about her grandson. Her grandson is, I think, moderately speaking, 50 times wiser than she is.
Oh, definitely.
The questions he asks triggers all questions. Wow, I didn't think of this. I have to give you an answer. And sometimes he can't even give the answer because it's so deep. I have a 15-month-old grandson today, likes to play in the car. And the car has two little buttons there, the horn, the tutor. And he was going boop, 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 having a lot of fun. So I went in there, I put my hands on it, and he couldn't reach it. Then he noticed on the other side, there's also another same design. He went toot, 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 toot. I had to give up. Now, nobody taught him that. Where is the technique for teaching him to be observant? Can you give me a technique? Okay, let me answer this question. Okay, if you got an answer, please, Charles, scold me after
Charles,
this. Now I'll give you a chance to answer.
Charles, can you hold this because it's recording and
it doesn't matter. You can record. I deny it.
You know what I'm saying? It's not recording properly because you keep moving it away.
Well, I don't care if they don't hear it. Who cares? I have no compassion. Nobody taught me compassion. Okay?
Now, you see what I mean about me having to take deep breath? Every minute, drop. Yeah.
Okay, to answer your question, I wasn't being nasty or anything, you know? I love everybody. I don't go selfish. This is one of the things I learned from Buddhism. Don't make enemies. It's better to have friends than enemies. Isn't it better? It's negative to have enemies. Anyway, what I want to emphasize is there is the aspect of life that we overlooked, which is the spiritual aspect. And spirituality is a bad word today because people don't know how to be spiritual. They have to be taught to be spiritual. And if you look at a baby, they are more spiritual than their parents. You think of your own lives. Don't take my word for it. Know for yourself, when you were kids, how often you look at your parents and you disapprove of things they do. Not right, not fair. Yeah, you are. You know, hitting some sense. The others, I mean, they're dead anyway. I'm not worried about that. But to those that really can go back to where they are, they will know that's the reality. That they have got all those goodness and they're badly treated. Why? Because it's not fair. Who taught them about fairness? Whose thesis was it about fairness to babies before when they were born? It comes out, they were born with the ingredients, with a network ready to be connected. And how it's connected is the conditioning and what you become. Okay? So we do have what emotional aspect.
I think to answer your question about the technique, right, which is why the... Yes, technique is very important because you still have to spend time to train your mind to come back to the focus, the breath. The technique is very important. But if you just stay at the technique, right, and don't practice and put it into your own life and cultivate a relationship with all the emotions and all that, it will just stay as a yoga practice. Right, you don't have to take your yoga practice home and do it. You just have to go to the studio or, you know, it's an exercise. But mindfulness is not an exercise. Mindfulness is an attitude. Because when you're mindful, you say, should I do that? Should I say that? Should I behave like that? You know what I mean? It pervades your whole life. Does that make sense? The training is just to bring your mind back to focus when you're reacting. Okay?
Yeah. You are mindful. I mean, you are absolutely mindful, aren't you? All you guys go around being mindfulness, you know, walking around with your head in the air, with your mind somewhere else, walking into a car. That's what happens, isn't it? When you meet with an accident, it's not because you didn't think about the accident. It just bloody well happened. And your mind wasn't there when it was happening. If your mind was there, when it was happening, you will avoid it. How many times have you done that in your life? Who taught you that? What was the technique for that? You know, my little 15, you know, he likes to climb chairs. His mother just bought him a huge thing. He's going to climb up there and fall over. But he doesn't. He feels it. Every step of the way, he wants to hold your hands to get up, to get a balance and all. 15 months old. Not taught. Now, this is true of life. You look at animals, they are not restless, they are very mindful things. If they were, they get eaten by other animals.
Sorry, Charles, can we move on? Yeah. So the next one is, there's a misconception that one has to be a Buddhist or follow the Buddhist religion in order to practice mindfulness. The real understanding is that mindfulness is a universal human capacity, and this is what Charles is alluding to. We are born to be mindful, except that we got so many things that we then inculcate that we actually lose that mindfulness. So mindfulness is what, like they said, it's a matter awareness. And the example I often give is, mindfulness is like your virus checker in a computer. It's always there, right? It just sits there, it doesn't do anything, it scans. And if it decides that this is a Trojan horse or something, it quarantines it or it destroys it, it decides what to do. Or if it's not so bad, right, if it's just a simple malware, it just lets it be. Mindfulness is like that. It's aware of everything. It's your own capacity to be present, right? And then you decide when this is important, you attend to it. The problem now is everybody attends to everything, right? Especially with Tinder. So that you'll get so full, so that you have to train your mind to be mindful. You don't actually have to train your mind to be mindful. I believe that you have to train your mind to be less mindless.
You train your mind to focus.
Does that make sense?
To be anything else. You train your mind to be here now. Just don't let your mind be somewhere else. Right now you're thinking of your boyfriend. Okay, good luck to you, man. But if you want to listen to what I'm saying, just bring your mind here and listen.
But no, the more important misconception is that one has to be a Buddhist. Now, my question is, a lot of the values, a lot of the Dharma that the Buddha taught are very universal. Love, loving kindness. They're not Buddhist, they're not Christian, they're not Hindu, they're Muslim. They are just universal values.
Yeah, but right? Without contradicting you, Mother, Buddhism, Buddha was the only person that brings it out in connection with real life.
That's because you haven't actually let me finish it. You see? Yeah. So what I do is let him finish talking and then
she's always fighting with
yeah.
How do you teach her to be nice to me?
Ella, can you? I think we better switch this off. But what I want to say is that there is a difference between the values that the religious teaches, which to me is similar, Islam and all that, and the way they actually put it in practice, or the methods they give you to cultivate it. And I think that the Dharma, I tend to call it the Dharma rather than Buddhism, because there's no Buddhism. Ism is all the English word. The Dharma is Buddha's teachings. The Dharma gives you a method to cultivate your mind, to train your mind, right? So that you actually are able to then help your mind to focus, to cultivate concentration, discipline and all that. So while a lot of religions teach the same values, right, they don't have the method to actually help you to actually foster or to cultivate those values. That to me, I think is a difference.
Yeah, I think that's a very significant difference between Buddhism and, for instance, Christianity or Islam. It does not say, thou shalt do this, and this is right, this is moral, this is immoral. When you go to listen to the Dharma talks, as I hope you guys do, listen closely to the message itself. And at no time would a monk tell you that you are bad. At no time does a monk tell you you have to change. Now, I don't know if you noticed that, but if you listen very closely for those instructions, you will never find them. Because there is nowhere in the scriptures, the Buddhist scriptures, that says that. The Buddha says, you do whatever you want if you're comfortable with it. Face up to the truth. And what is the truth? You know the truth. How do you define the truth? Philosophers have tried for years and they can't do it. What is true is the Dharma. What is the Dharma? The Dharma is what is. Simple as that. Don't complicate it.
Like, for example, one of the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, is that change is in the nature of things. Right? Everything changes. Life changes, condition changes, the weather changes, time moves on. Our personal life change. Sometimes we have to associate with people we like, sometimes we have to associate with people we don't like. Our body changes. So if we accept that change is in the nature of things, we don't have to get so aggravated when we age or when we grow sick, because it is in the nature of things. So his teachings are not about worship and things like that. His teachings are about look at things as they are. Right, so that's why I said that we don't actually have to follow the Buddhist religion as opposed to understanding the Buddha's teaching. Because the religion is the rituals. It helps. I mean, a lot of the rituals are very powerful rituals. It helps you to get a sense of community. It helps you to get a sense of belonging. But it's not necessary for the practice itself to be mindful that you have to follow a particular ritual.
Okay. I want to, again, I love that question. How do you, what's the technique for whatever it is? How do you learn to be compassionate? Are you compassionate? I guess not.
Tough. Hold it.
Huh?
Don't beat up. It's
okay. I guess not.
You see, everything I do is wrong. Everything I say is wrong. I don't know what I'm doing here.
Never mind. she loves to pick on me. I love her. Anyway,
great.
How do you have compared? You know, I get a lot of people that went to the MBS John's retreat when he was out here in 2009, and now they're all experts in that, and some of them are advocating teach you how to be self-compassionate.
Is being compassionate being kind to yourself?
Sorry?
Is that showing kindness to yourself?
That's right, self-compassion.
Self-compassion. To be self-compassionate. How? I mean, I guess you guys are so ignorant now, I don't know why you think you're Buddhist. You're not compassionate. Okay, let me ask you this question. You know, I'll give you an example. You know, in my days, I did science once, you know, I thought I was clever, then I found I wasn't. Anyway, I failed. One reason I failed was we had to get a rabbit. In those days, you dissect a rabbit. I don't know if you do science, I don't know if you still do it now. You pin the four legs out, pin, and you slice it out there, and open it out with pins, and see the functions of the liver, the heartbeat, the lungs, to know what it is about. Anyway, I couldn't do it. I had a Norwegian girl try to do it for me, and finally I walked out and I failed. That was the first subject I failed. How do you feel when I describe what I was doing?
How do you feel?
No feelings at all? You feel fine? Hooray! He's killed it. No? How do you feel?
I feel sad for the rabbit.
Say that again?
Sad for the rabbit.
Sad for the rabbit. Oh, the poor rabbit. Go on. What else? The others don't feel anything, right? Some people were just disgusted. You know? I said, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I didn't like it. It is your bloody sense of compassion that you're complaining about, not me. Compassion. Right? You have it. You know why you don't know you have it? Because you don't pay attention to when you have it. When it happens, and you were there when it happens, as it was happening now. When I was describing, you were listening and you were following. Yeah. Most of the times, you don't give a damn anyway. You, killing a rabbit, that's good. And then you think about, oh, that was nice. Oh, it's all past. I don't feel anything anymore. That is the condition that we are in. That's why we need to train our mind to be in the present. And if we are in the present, we would notice it, as you did with the story I gave you, and you would know for yourself that you are a compassionate person. Don't rely on anybody to tell you that. No, don't rely on anybody to tell you that you have a lot of empathy, a lot of sympathy, you are this, you are that, spiritual.
I think the message
they
is
don't
that,
know that
a lot of the things through mindfulness and meditation that you learn to acquire are already in you. That's why we say that it cannot be taught. You can have the technique to train your mind, but the virtues and the values that you bring out as a consequence of that discipline are already there. Right? Except that in the process of growing up, we lose it. Okay, so moving on. Yeah, so with Charles, I'm sorry, this is for the recording, right? He will digress, and I'll never finish my slides. So,
anyway, right?
Anyway, so I thought I'll cover this, and then if you've got other questions, and we usually do, I know there's usually another hour after the hour that we talk, that's fine. But I also want to say that it's not just mindfulness that we're talking about, but right mindfulness, right? So we are often mindful, as I said, of everything, of the people that hurt us, of the people that don't like us, are sensitive to that. But right mindfulness is actually being mindful of the things that make you happy or bring peace or calmness or serenity. Okay? In other words, skillful mindfulness. I think this is very important because people talk about mindfulness as if it is a thing. Like I saw this interview on the British parliamentarian. The interviewer was asked her, so how many sessions did you do before you got it right? She said, I never get it right. But say, you know, six weeks, 5 weeks, they talk of it as if it's an object that you acquire, right? What she was saying was, she started to see that her mind tends to ruminate and react, and that's why she gets depressed. And now she doesn't do it anymore. And again, the interviewer asked, so how many months did it take you to do that? And that's what I have to think about skill and technique, okay?
That rumination is a natural process of our existence. So, we have to learn to avoid the ruminations, to rest our mind. This is why we have the discipline of meditation. And if we have that discipline and we're able to be present with everything that's going on, whether it's through the ears, the senses, or through the thoughts, or through the feelings, then we will see the truth. These are the noble truths. That's right. Right-mindedness is being mindful about what the Dharma is about.
Okay, so meditation, this is one of the myths. Meditation and mindfulness, not just relaxation, right? And this is the thing that really bothers me is when people ask, oh, it's like this, or it's like that, it's like yoga, it's like Pilates. Yes, there is that element of relaxation. But I don't know whether you're getting a sense now that mindfulness is more than exercises, right? It's an attitude, right? And like the other day, Charles and I run Sunday sessions. Every Sunday, we've been doing it for 5 years now for members of the public. And so the other day, we have this group, and they've been doing it for 3 years now. I asked him, how do they now find mindfulness and meditation? And he said, well, he still has this difficulty because he builds metal tools. That when he's using the machine, sometimes his mind is wanders. And I say, what do you do? He said, then I bring it back. But he says, my mind shouldn't wander. And therefore, I'm not mindful. And I said, that's a misconception. Because the mind wanders anyway, all the time. That's what the mind does. Except now that he's more mindful when it wanders, right? And he has the ability to pull it back as soon as it wanders. Usually, our mind wanders, we daydream for 2-3 hours, we look at the same page of the book for hours and hours, and then we just realize, oop, not there. If you're mindful, if you're mindful, you're aware of the wandering of the mind, except now you can make a choice to either continue with the wandering or the daydreaming or to pull it back. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's not simply relaxation, it's a way of engaging with your mind and body. In my client calls it in real time. Because usually we engage with our mind and body with hindsight or from hindsight rather than in real time. Does that make sense? Yeah? So it's not just simply relaxation. Okay?
That's another book I want to recommend. Ajahn Sumedho's book on meditation. Read that book. It's very interesting.
Which title, Charles?
Huh?
Which title?
Meditation.
Now what's the book? What's the title of the book?
It's something to do. It's meditation, something meditation. What is it?
But I think if I'm not...
Sumedho, I think there's a word meditation on the title, that's the book.
I think it's called... I think Ajahn Sumedho is the Four Noble Truths. He writes a lot of books, so it's a bit hard. I think it's the Four Noble Truths. Now, so this is another myth that it's for the holy people only, not for ordinary people. And so this monk is asking the other monk, my mind is especially empty today, right? Meditation and mindfulness is for everybody. In fact, you don't have to go away from anywhere to actually meditate. The harder thing is actually to be mindful in the midst of chaos and busyness. And that's when you need it the most. Okay? The difficulty I find when I train people is they only do it when they have health problem or they have crisis or their emotional problems, and then for the rest of the time they don't. Now, you cannot train your mind as Davidson's and all the research have shown, you cannot train your mind to do it intermittently, right? You have to keep pulling it back. I've been doing meditation for 25 years now, and I find that if I don't do it consistently, it takes me longer to actually pull my mind back when I'm stressed. Okay? The difference now is I'm more aware when I am stressed. Last time I'm stressed, and then 6 months later, then I might be aware of it. Okay? Now, then they say that meditation is running away from reality. So I'm going to Europe to find myself, and John is going to Asia to find himself. Right? We think that we have to go to somewhere, to a retreat or somewhere, before we can actually practice meditation. Or we have to. This one is about what we call geographical solution. Right? You think that if you go somewhere in a retreat, your mind will still. Right. It doesn't still. In fact, you'll find it's really scary because nobody else talks to you. And John Kabat-Zinn runs a CEO retreat for the Fortune 500 companies in America, and he takes them to the desert. And he makes them sit all day, all night, for 10 days, right, in silence. And he says one of the insights that they get is very scary. They said, we run 500 Fortune company, we have control of $500 million, we cannot even be in control of our breath. That's the kind of insight they get, right? That they're not in charge of their body or their mind, and they're trying to control the rest of the company, right? So it's not about running away from reality, it's about staying anchoring with yourself and your thoughts all the time.
Mindfulness is about reconditioning your attitudes or mind. It trains your mind to be different from where you are. A different being, less and less rumination, more and more attention, paying attention to what is. And what is the Dharma. So right mindfulness is paying attention to what is. Right now, you're sitting there judging me. That's what is. That's the truth. Okay?
Any questions so far? Okay. So this one is interesting because we get asked this all the time. Meditation is not goal-orientated. Are we there yet? Right? When I teach people meditation, I always say, so are we there yet? Am I finding my breath? And then you ask people, you know, focus on the breath. They start to breathe like differently. I said, you know, just breathe normally, right? Meditation is not different from our normal way of life, okay? But people tend to associate a lot of esoteric practices, you know, can I count this? And one person told me that the teacher gave him a secret mantra to do, and I said, does it help? He says, I'm not allowed to share that with you. And they make it so highfalutin. And she said, what happens if I don't like the mantra? I said, well, you know, why don't you talk to the teacher? But if you tell me, maybe we can find out why. You know? Oh, no, I cannot share with you. Now, I don't know the teacher, but I believe that there's a lot of teachers who try to keep the audience captivated, right, and trapped. Because real meditation and mindfulness and good teachers free you. They do not enslave your mind or your royalty to them. Okay?
As part of the meditation process, you have the benefit of looking at yourself without anybody else knowing about it. And you can get to know yourself, and if you know yourself truly, right, correctly, rightfully, you may find things that you don't like about yourself, but you don't have to tell anybody. But if you were meditating on the Dharma, you know you could be different. You could have a better choice than being who you are. So you act that way. You become different. Nobody even knows that. And ultimately, people say, hey, wait a minute, you're a different person. What the hell is wrong with you, you know? Then you secretly know for yourself that I've got rid of some of my afflictive emotions. Emotions that, like anger. I used to be angry. Every time she sees me, she is bloody rash. You know, rage. Well, if she can meditate and say, he's not such a bad person, he's livable, you know, and quietly drop that rage, then she might even love me.
Thanks for your advice.
I don't need it. Does meditation always require the body to be still?
Sorry?
Does meditation always require the body to be still?
No.
Well, that's another myth, you know. I went to... on a university, one of the teachers was teaching people. Now, you have to actually cross your legs this way, and you have to sit this way, and the poor buggers for half an hour trying to get to the posture. Right? It doesn't matter. You can sit down, you can lie down, you can do whatever. Stand up, you stand on your head if you want to. It's a state of your mind, not your body.
Actually, yeah, so different traditions have different ways. The Theravada, which is the most basic ones, follow the Buddha from India to Southeast Asia. They wear ochre robe. That's very simple. It's basically focusing on the breath, right, and just, you know, letting your mind rest. The Zen practice is a little bit more rituals or austere. They tend to have a stool and they face the wall. But for a simple reason, they think that if you face the wall and your senses are less captivated by what you see, your ability to rest your mind is easier. And then the Tibetans have other practices. And one of the practices, the Tibetan one in the Wollongong, is they tend to actually use the statue of the Buddha as an image, or as an object of focus, right? And they try and sit like the way the Buddha is sitting or things like that. But that's because they're trying to emulate the virtues of the Buddha. Unlike what people think, this is one of the myths. They pray to the Buddha. They don't. When you go to Nantian Temple in Wollongong,